The topic of this talk is going beyond scientific and religious dogmas and discovering the truth. Yeah, everyone, please sit. You want to come forward? All right. Is this not loud enough? It's pretty loud, huh? Okay, everyone seated comfortably. All right, let's start again. The topic of this talk is going beyond scientific and religious dogmas and discovering the truth. So, one way man is distinguished from the animals is that people have a worldview. We operate according to a worldview. Everyone needs a moral, ethical, directional compass by which to lead their life. Some people are committed to a religion, some people are committed to atheism, some people are committed to making lots of money, some people are committed to research, some people are committed to their family. We may have multi-commitments, but we have an outlook on life, even if we don't specifically formulate that. Some people have a formulated worldview, just like I am a Christian, that has a whole worldview that goes with it. I am an atheist, that has a worldview that goes with it. Most people don't have a formulated worldview, but they have goals in life. To make money or to live comfortably, they have what they consider to be morals, to work hard, enjoy yourself. In every worldview, there is some kind of faith, because you can't know everything about anything, whatever it may be. Whatever we do, whatever we think, whatever we goals, they're based on some kind of faith. Just like, for instance, the idea, let me work hard, that's based on the idea that by doing so, I will be doing the right thing for myself and my community and my country. So there's some inbuilt faith there. Religious faith is generally known as dogma, which is, the word dogma is often a derogatory term. An example of religious dogma is that which I was taught in school and in church when I was young. I don't know if it's still taught in the schools and in the church. The church. In Northern Ireland, if you say the church, then the question comes, which church? Anyway, I was told, or is led to believe, that all the problems in the world, all the suffering we see, all the inequality, all the cruelty, all the pain, all the disease, all stems from the fact that an ancestor of ours long ago ate an apple. And this was taught as religious education. That is, by people who don't believe that, that is called a dogma. So, over the last few hundred years, many people have become discontent with what they consider to be religious dogma. And especially at the present time, there is a worldwide movement against religious dogma, with the idea that we should be more rational and try and understand what's going in the world through observation and intelligence, and especially through science. But then we find that people who subscribe to what they would call the scientific worldview, they also inadvertently maybe adopt a dogma with the idea that by science we can understand everything that needs to be known. By science we can understand what is reality. Based on the dogma or the unproved and unprovable assumption that we can access reality through our senses and our intelligence. By observation and hypothesis, we can understand everything that needs to be, or everything that exists. Reality can be understood by the scientific method, by observation and hypothesis. And then there should follow experimentation, but in some cases it's not possible, as for instance with the hypothesis that the whole universe came out of a big bang. It's not possible to make an experiment to attempt to replicate that. So whatever worldview we subscribe to, we become attached to that because we need to see the world through some kind of explanation. Unlike animals, humans don't just eat and sleep and pass something out of their backsides and reproduce. Humans are supposed to be thinking, and Homo sapiens, sapiens means sapient, intelligent. But we can't know everything about anything, what to speak about knowing everything about everything. And so we tend to adopt a worldview without knowing everything about it, nor is it possible to know everything about anything. And most people who call themselves religious, they don't know what the theology of their religion is beyond some very basic points. The catechism used to be taught. But the religious discussion, the theological discussion that goes behind that, most people are unaware of it. For most people, they're simply content to go to a church and say, I'm a Christian, or I'm a Protestant, or I'm a Catholic, or whatever. And similarly, there are many people who do not consider themselves religious, and they think, well, science has it all worked out for us. But they don't know what these scientific proofs are of the things that they believe in. Just like, and of course, we have to speak in very broad terms here, because many people, they subscribe both to a scientific cum religious worldview. For instance, about the Big Bang, which is widely accepted as being the cause of the universe. There are very few people who understand all the reasoning or behind that, but most people just accept it. So for the people who don't understand the reasoning behind it, it can be considered a dogmatic acceptance that there was a big bang and gradually everything fell into place and here we all are. And even those who do accept it, they tend to accept it dogmatically. That means that although the scientific outlook is supposed to be neutral and value-free, but people latch onto it as people latch on to religious dogmas, because we all need a worldview by which to live. We can't do without that. So we tend to want to believe whatever supports our worldview and to disbelieve whatever appears to, or whatever anyone offers as a contradiction. Even though we don't know everything to back it up, and there may be some serious objections to it, but we feel, different people feel attracted to different kind of dogmas, we could say. I'll give an example. Who has read The God Delusion? The well-known book of the modern age. The God Delusion by Richard Dawkins. You've read it, yeah. Okay. Now, among the various arguments that he gave, I found one argument, which wasn't a major argument of his, but I found it very, very weak and almost childish in its weakness. He related an incident that from his own childhood, where in the night he saw something moving on the curtains in his bedroom, and he was afraid, thinking that it was a ghost. And you remember reading that? You probably don't. It's a big book. And then he got up and saw it was just some light reflected from outside, and there was no ghost there at all. And from then on, he didn't believe in ghosts. Now, I thought that was a very weak argument, considering that throughout history, all cultures, even those which have not been connected with each other, they've all reported ghosts. People have, at least they say, seen and experienced ghosts. And even in the modern age, there was, I believe it was in the 1970s, there was a Delta Airlines flight from somewhere in the southern USA to someone in Latin America, which Delta Airlines, even though it was a profitable route, they had to cancel that flight because none of their staff would fly on it because there was a ghost in the flight. Because one of the planes crashed and the captain kept on coming on the flight, the ghost of the captain, and there's a best-selling book about it. I mean, that's just one example. So I'm not making a case here for ghosts or against ghosts. I'm just saying that the way he flippantly tossed out the very conception or possibility that ghosts could exist without any rigid scientific investigation suggests that he's also attached to a dogma, that people have worldviews and they're attached to that, and by any means they want to uphold that. And we also tend to want to share that with others also, to bolster our own confidence in our worldview. And I guess you could say, I'm doing the same thing here. Well, let's see what you think. So, the Dawkins, he's attached to a materialistic worldview. He's whether or not there's God and whether or not there are ghosts, the two are not exactly linked, but it's the materialistic worldview of science. By materialistic, I don't mean here getting lots of money and getting a big house and dressing in fancy clothes, but I mean the a priori rejection of the possibility of there being anything beyond matter, that matter is all there is. There is no supernatural or spiritual dimension. So that is one kind of dogma, if you like, because, why not? Again, that so many people throughout history have reported that spiritual experience, mystic experiences. Of course, that's the whole point of the God delusion. He considers it to be a delusion. There have been experiments in which electromagnetic waves are applied to the brain, and people, by having that applied to different parts of the brain, they feel hunger, thirst, depression. They can also have mystic or spiritual experiences. But interestingly, one of the main researcher in this one, Dr. Ramachandran in San Diego, because people could have mystic or theistic experiences, he suggested that this doesn't mean that it's just something in the brain, but it suggests that it's something real. because the fact that we feel hunger is, it's a real response to a real need. And so he suggested that the brain is a mechanism through which the self experiences consciousness. Anyway, I won't go down that alley. Now, scientific dogma. I spoke a little bit about religious dogma. I'm speaking more about what I'm calling scientific dogma, because the topic of religious, generally dogma, the term is associated with religion. But I just want to point out here, because it's not often pointed out, that there is what we might call scientific dogma also. We're generally taught that, well, science means we know what we're talking about and we got it all worked out. Or if we haven't got it worked out, we're on the way to getting it worked out. The scientific outlook is that materialistic, that everything in reality can be understood through observation and through hypothesis, by human endeavor, by exercising human intelligence. But this to me seems to be a very unreasonable premise. Why should we presume that everything in reality is accessible to our senses and understandable by our intelligence, by the method of observation? Why should we presume that? Why should we presume that anything that can't be quantified or measured, it's just some fairy stories? Why should we presume that? Scientific dogma. I'll give an example from my childhood. In school, in biology class, I was taught that simple cells, and particularly simple cells, are very simple organisms. And very soon scientists will be able to make cells in a laboratory. Later, quite a few years later, I was told that when I was discussing this with someone, I said, no, that's not true. That scientists might have thought that once, but now they know that cells, I'm talking here about organic cells, as such as we find in bodies and in plants and so on. I was told, no, that's not true. And the scientists now know that cells are far more complex than they had originally presumed. And that's where that was the starting point for the intelligent design vector of many scientists. So, quite some time after that, I discovered that not only had scientists rejected what they at one time thought to be science in this regard, that cells are very simple organisms that will soon be able to be artificially replicated in the laboratory, not only did I discover that that was no longer considered valid science, but I also discovered that at the time that I was taught it, scientists already knew that it wasn't valid science. So why did they teach it to me? Well, I guess it takes time for the scientific discoveries to filter down into the curricula. But in the meantime, I was taught something which scientists knew to be untrue, and I was taught it in the name of science. In this regard, I'll just another anecdote. Some years ago at a science conference, I met a scientist, and I had some discussion with him about on the topic that life cannot arise from matter. And I presumed that he would not agree with that. I presumed that he would say that, yes, life does arise from matter, but he laughed when I said this. He said, yeah, we already know that. We know that life can't arise from matter. I don't know. I didn't ask him at the time who he meant by we. So I asked him, why do you still teach it? And he said, well, we don't have anything else to teach. We don't have anything better to teach. So this is what we might call scientific dogma, that we are attached to a certain worldview and we don't want to admit the weaknesses in it, or that we are ignorant about certain things, and so we just go on teaching it. Now, presumably, everyone here accepts that subatomic particles exist. Anyone want to make a case against it? I'm not one to argue for or against it, because I don't know what would be considered proof of the existence of subatomic particles. Does anyone here know what would be considered proof of the existence of subatomic particles? Anyone? Anyone? No. But everyone agrees that subatomic particles exist. No one objects to that. So we all accept, that means, it seems, that we all accept on faith that subatomic particles exist. Isn't it? If we don't know the proof, then we accept on faith. We believe what scientists tell us, that subatomic particles exist. And it seems that they gradually go on discovering more and more. So, most people, they accept, whatever we accept in terms of scientific discovery, or what we believe to be science, we accept it on faith, because scientists tell us so. So in other words, we could call it a dogmatic faith. Now, there's a problem in science. There are many problems in science. But one major problem arises when we see that different groups of scientists, both with access to the same scientific discoveries and information, and both trained in the same basic scientific manner, and both highly qualified, come to completely different and opposing conclusions. And I specifically have in mind the theory of evolution. Of course, there are different stages of evolution, that the universe has come into being by chance or not chance, or by some singularity. The universe has come into being, that living beings have evolved from matter, that from very simple living beings have evolved more complex beings. That is one outlook that's the standard outlook of scientists, orthodox scientists, who have they have much data, much information, much research to refer to, and they're also trained to process and understand the research materials, which probably, or maybe none of us here are. We may be taught in a very simple way in school, but to understand all the intricacies of it, I don't know if anyone understands all the intricacies with all the... You'd have to be a geologist and a biologist, geneticist, and so many. It's interdisciplinary. But there are other scientists who have studied the same data. They have the same information available. And they're also highly qualified and respected in their fields. And they come to the conclusion that it's too complex to have arisen by random interaction of chemicals in the beginning, and later by what is called natural selection. They subscribe to the theory of intelligent design, which borders or practically is theism. So, for a layman like myself, I'm not a scientist, as anyone who's even slightly a scientist must have already deduced. For a layman like me, it strongly suggests that what is called science is really not as scientific or not as sure about itself as is claimed to be. I mean, individuals may be sure. Richard Dawkins, for instance, one among many, is sure that we are all here today as a result of biological evolution. And there are other scientists who are equally convinced that this is not possible. So, what are we talking about here? Are we talking about something that's fixed, clear, understood, as sure as day follows night and night follows day, as sure as 2 + 2 = 4, as sure as death? Or are we talking about some opinions? Are we talking about some dogmas? What does it come down to? Is someone doing good science, someone is doing bad science? What we're talking about for sure is the human factor that different people interpret in different ways. And for the layman who doesn't have a lifetime to spend, and not everyone has the intelligence or the inclination to study all these things, he simply has to accept one or the other on faith or remain an agnostic about all these things. For the layman, if one scientist says evolution and the other one says no, it's intelligent design, which may have preceded evolution, then for the layman, which means most people in the world, there's no way that they can navigate their way through all of this and come to an intelligent conclusion, because the scientists themselves disagree. Science is not as definite as we are led to believe. Some years ago, I read in a magazine that among astrophysicists, there are about 2,000 theories, including sub-theories, of the origin of the universe. And I thought, well, how many astrophysicists are there in the world? They're probably not more than 2,000. I discussed this with an astrophysicist, and she said, well, maybe there aren't even that many, but some of them have more than one theory. Smart people to come up with more than one theory. And of course, most of them would be sub-theories of main theories. So, it's very difficult to navigate our way through all this stuff. Now, another point, getting into another point here, is that everyone in the world, even those who deny that there is anything beyond the physical, everyone accepts that there is something metaphysical. For instance, I don't think anyone, any humanist or atheist or religionist or whatever they may be, even if they're not an ist of any kind, they're just someone working and trying to earn a living, no one would agree, for instance, that to torture children is something good. Anyone want to make a case for torturing children is good? Some people might make a case that torture has some use in some cases, although that's highly debatable. But it's very difficult to make a case for torturing children. It's bad, it's evil. Now, what is this good and bad? If we as human beings are all simply a bundle of chemicals, and what's good or bad about anything? This dust thou art, unto dust thou shalt return. This is not a religious statement. It's simply a statement about the body, that the body is formed from indiscriminate matter, and it returns, matter forms into a body, and during the duration of the existence of the body, it continues to transform at every moment. And eventually that body, which we tend to think of as myself, it dies, and then the body, unless it's mummified or in other ways preserved, it tends to very quickly merge with the greater mass of matter. It may be eaten by worms, it may be burned, that's a common way of disposing of most of the body, just gets consumed in a fire, some little bit doesn't. So, what is it if we as beings are simply a conglomerate of chemicals, then what's good or bad about anything, ultimately? If you have a flask with some chemical in it, and you break the flask and all the chemical spills, well, we may also say that's bad, it's not very good, but it doesn't have the same moral impact. It doesn't incite revulsion in us as the murder of a child might have. If in law also, even in an atheistic country, if someone smashes up a car, that's considered a crime. If it's someone else, well, especially if it's someone else's car. But if you smash up someone's body, that's considered a worse crime. Why? The car is a machine made of chemicals. The body is a machine made of chemicals. Why do we put so much stress on the body being more important than a car? Why do we naturally feel it wrong if there is unfairness in the world, and what to speak of that's maybe the most gruesome example that could be given, of torturing little children? Why? What's wrong with it? The very sense of right and wrong suggests that there is something more than simply chemicals. Unless we take this all as one big delusion, everything's just a big delusion. But if we think like that, then we might feel justified in torturing little children. We might think like that. Well, what does it matter? What does it matter? We may think like that, but anyone who has any sensitivity, which isn't something that you can measure by any scientific instrument, will understand that to think like this is horrible, inhuman. Certainly it's wrong to torture children, and there are many, many things which are wrong. I'm just giving that as an example. Another example of metaphysical belief in people who claim not to accept anything to be supernatural, metaphysical, supernatural, they're similar terms, is belief in the Big Bang, which is said to be a singularity. Singularity is another way of saying a miracle. It doesn't happen according to ordinary laws of nature. It just, how, why, from what it happened, no explanation. What happened? What was there before the Big Bang? It's considered a non-question. Time began. So that, in that sense, it's supernatural, in as much as it can't be described, it can't be ascribed to any scientific laws. So this is all metaphysical. Now, so far I've spoken about the topic of the talk is beyond scientific and religious dogmas, discovering reality. Now, what is reality? So far we spoke about, I spoke a lot about science, and I guess I should speak a little bit more about religious dogma. That by religious understanding, people, they see the world through those eyes. We tend to see the world through those eyes. For instance, one person sees a tree, and they see that this, they may not think about it, but for every tree they see, but if they start to think about it, they'll say, well, this tree came about due to natural selection. And they'll see everything in the world, and even how humans behave with each other and interact. They want to explain it all in terms of, ultimately in terms of evolutionary theory, that anthropology and culture, it's all derived from man's desire to survive and to dominate and to enjoy. So everything is explained with that worldview. Now, if a theist may see a tree, well, there are different kinds of theists. I'm sure there are different kinds of scientists also, but I'm not so much up on that field. Someone may say, well, the tree is put there by God because it looks very nice and it gives us oxygen, it gives us fruit. It's given by God to us. Another kind of theist would say that that is a living being in that body who has to has taken that life form because of some previous action, because for every action there is an equal and opposite reaction which happens on the subtle or karmic platform also. So everyone sees everything through their worldview, and how people behave with each other. Some people will say that, well, there are basically two classes of people. One class has found the truth in Jesus, and the other class are just inspired by Satan, so everything they say is all wrong. And of course there are others who will say that, well, Satan, yes, and Jesus, just one of the prophets, and the last prophet is Muhammad. And they see the world through this worldview. Everyone has a different worldview. But beyond all these different worldviews, there is reality. There are certain facts. Although we try to fit everything within our worldview, and we try to explain everything that we see, touch, taste, smell, feel, and hear according to our worldview, the reality is independent of what we presume it to be. For instance, people often ask me, do you believe in reincarnation? And my standard first response to that is that it doesn't matter whether I believe in it or not. Because if it's a fact, it's a fact. And if it's not a fact, then there's no amount of believing in it will make it into a fact. It's either a fact or it's not a fact. It's not that if you believe in it, it happens. And if you don't believe in it, it doesn't happen. Similarly, is there God, one God, or many gods? It's not a question of belief. It's either a fact or it isn't a fact. Reality is independent of whatever we may consider it to be, unless we got it right. So, how do we find out that reality? Well, that's really what science and religion are both striving for. In this little talk, I've been talking about science and religion as different fields, which they, to a large extent, operate differently. I'm speaking in general terms here, so forgive me for that. So, both are trying to understand reality, which shows that we as intelligent beings, we have an innate desire to try to find out what is the meaning of life. There are many people who are simply satisfied to work in a job if they can get one, come home at night, turn on the TV, go to sleep, and get up the next morning and do the same thing. And many people are content with that. Those who are not content with that, they search for more meaning. And the universe, as we can observe it, or everything in nature, everything that we see, it suggests that it does have meaning. The very fact that there are scientific laws waiting to be discovered, some that will, in course of time, have to be modified, this suggests that there is meaning. If there's no meaning, then how is it all so ordered? We can say it comes from simply by chance. But then why are we so concerned to find out? Why are we so concerned to find out the meaning? The very fact that we search for meaning suggests that there is meaning. And even if we say that there's nothing beyond evolution, then why are we so anxious to communicate that to others? The meaning, we are by nature meaningful people. It suggests, just like if we're thirsty, it suggests we have a real need for water. If we're hungry, it suggests there's a real need for food. So the search for meaning and the order of the universe. Now, you may say, this is going a bit beyond logic. It's a bit of a leap of faith. But if we don't make some leap in some direction, we can't make any progress in understanding. Just like if you go to the university to study science, some discipline within the broad field known as science, you start off with some faith that there's something to be learned. You don't know what you're going to learn, but you have faith that there's something worthwhile pursuing here. From what little we've seen of it, we have faith that it's worth pursuing. So that there is meaning in the universe suggests that, and that we try to find out that knowledge about it, suggests that there is knowledge and that it is understandable. But at the same time, we are very tiny living beings. We have a very short life. We are in a very tiny part of the cosmos with very limited access to the rest of it. Even we don't know everything that we're not, we can't be sure that everything going on around us is limited to what we perceive with our senses and presume with our intelligence. Our intelligence is very limited. We tend to make mistakes. So how can we know reality? Okay. Discovering reality. Now for the big leap of faith, if you like, where I'm coming from. Obviously, or at least you can deduce from my dress, that I have a specific worldview. Yeah. So, I subscribe to the broad worldview that is called Vedic. Veda is a Sanskrit term which means knowledge. Sometimes it's said that the Vedas are the scriptures of the Hindus. Scripture generally means something, is generally understood to mean something that we should believe. But the approach in the Vedas is different. The whole approach is try to understand. Just try to understand. That this, now, who wrote the Vedas? You may say, well, they're written by man, but according to the tradition, they're not written by man. It's knowledge which exists. Knowledge of any entity or phenomenon always exists along with that entity or phenomenon, independent of the entity or phenomenon. For instance, that we could say that Belfast is a city in Northern Ireland, capital of Northern Ireland. Okay, but that's a fact. But that fact exists independently of Belfast. Belfast is a city, it's here. The fact that it's the capital of Northern Ireland, that fact is not exactly the same as the entity called Belfast. Or getting into more abstract items, 2 + 2 = 4. That's an abstract statement. Two anything. 2 + 2 = 4. So that knowledge exists independent. You can bring 2 apples and then bring another 2 apples and say now we have 4 apples. But the knowledge of arithmetic is independent of the apples. So knowledge of actual knowledge as opposed to opinions, that is always existing. As long as an entity exists, the facts about it always exist. So Veda means knowledge, and it's not given, according to its own tradition, it's not given by any human being, and it's not even created by God, because knowledge of God also exists independently of God. Of course, that, well, when we're talking about scripture, we're talking about God. So, the Vedas purport to give us knowledge of reality in 2 divisions. One is called paravidya, one is called aparavidya. These are technical terms. One means knowledge of the material world, and one means knowledge of the spiritual existence. So in the Vedas, there is knowledge of much of which modern science has discovered. We, for instance, we speak of Arabic numerals as opposed to Roman numerals. Arabic numerals with the 0 made mathematics as we know it today possible with Arabic numerals. But the Arabic numerals actually came from the Vedic corpus of knowledge. And within the Vedic corpus of knowledge, there is astronomy, geometry, which are, of course, all based on more than basic arithmetic, but on advanced mathematics. We have in the Vedas terms such as Paramanu, which means the smallest entity, which is translated as atom. Although the English word atom isn't really an atom, because the atom is the word atom is derived from a Greek term which means the smallest thing. It was considered the smallest at the time. So in the Vedic knowledge, I'm just giving a few examples here. There's a whole system of medicine which is used, widely used even today. Some of you may have heard of it. It's called Ayurveda. Veda means knowledge, and Ayu means life, so it's knowledge of life. astronomy, medicine, mathematics. So various fields of knowledge are there in the material world. Psychology. And there's also knowledge of the what is the underlying principle of everything. Now, in the Vedic knowledge, although the underlying principle of everything, which is vaguely referred to in the English language, may be referred to as God, that knowledge is there. But prior to that, there are some, the Vedas offer some very important knowledge of our situation here, now that we're all in, that all of us can understand without studying anything spiritual whatsoever. For instance, the fact that in this material world there is suffering. We all have to suffer. There is the suffering of disease, there is the suffering of old age, there is the suffering of death, there's the suffering of birth. The Vedas point out to us, we could say we could deduce it ourselves, but most people don't, that everything that every living being, not only humans do, but everything every living being does, we do for the sake of minimally survival, and beyond that, happiness, or at least negating threats to our comfort. So, to put it simply, we are all seeking happiness. Everyone seeks happiness. No one would disagree with that. Anyone? Anyone wants to be unhappy? Well, some people have, that's a strange psychological condition in which people want to be unhappy, but that's a perverse kind of happiness. So everything that everyone does, they do for the sake of happiness. Every living being, not only humans, even the plants, the trees will grow toward the light because they get in their very constricted state of consciousness, they find happiness in the light. But the Vedic knowledge points out to us that Gopal, give some prasad. Despite our attempts to be happy, we must suffer distress. So the Vedic knowledge points us toward that state of consciousness in which we can always experience happiness, and that this should be, this is the ultimate meaning of life, to seek and find full happiness. Now that may seem rather selfish, but in finding our own happiness, that doesn't mean that we neglect everyone. If someone just acts for their own happiness, in the materialistic sense, that usually means that they're not concerned with anyone else. But in Vedic understanding, to seek for one's own happiness means also to attempt to help others also achieve that, knowing that we're all living beings are on the spiritual platform equal. Now, I just said the word spiritually equal. So what does that spiritual mean? Well, we are all spiritual, and we can understand that. Again, remember I'm saying I'm not asking for blind faith here, but understanding. There is knowledge, we should try to understand it, beyond opinion. Now, one example that's given in the preliminary Vedic knowledge is that we're all born, We grow up, we grow old, we die. Okay, that's nothing very, that doesn't sound like very advanced knowledge to say that. But what's happening here, if we examine, is that the body is born, grows, and eventually dies. But in the journey of life from birth, childhood, youth, adulthood, old age, and death, the person stays the same. The body is always changing. The mind is always changing. But the person stays the same. Those who have white hairs on their head, including me, I do have some hair up here, there's a little bit, didn't shave recently. We can see photos when there were no crow's feet under our eyes. Oh, for that day. Gone forever. When we didn't have gray hairs, the body has changed. The body is changing at every second. The mind is always changing. Even our, not just, of course, the mind is changing at every moment. We could suddenly get angry, for instance. But our whole mindset may change also. For instance, generally it's expected that older people are more calm than younger people. There's hope for you yet. So the mind, the general mindset may change. But the mind is always changing, the body is always changing, but the person stays the same. And I'm told that, maybe if there's any doctor here, they could confirm or deny this, but I'm told that according to medical science, every 7 years or so, every cell in the body will have been changed. And then whatever chemicals are in this body weren't in it 8 years ago. So if I say that I am this body, what am I exactly? Am I the genetic code? Well, that's also some chemicals. Am I chemicals? What stays the same? The person. That, the Vedas inform us, that is which gives life to the body. That is the soul. And thus, life cannot arise from matter because life is intrinsically a different kind of energy or phenomenon to that which matter is. It's a different kind of energy. In other words, we as living beings are by nature spiritual. And that also means that we have no intrinsic connection with the matter of this world. So that's the beginning. That's the beginning of spiritual knowledge, to understand that we are not this body, that we do get body after body after body, because we carry along with us a stockpile of desires, which we try to fulfill in different bodies. We carry with us a stockpile of activities for which we get a reaction to. If we do something good, then we'll get something good. Something good will happen to us in future. Luck is not so lucky. Some people are very lucky, aren't they? The luck of the Irish. Is it really lucky to be born in Ireland? I guess the immigration doesn't uphold that. So, good luck, bad luck, it's all a reaction. For every action, there is a reaction on the karmic level. how to get beyond all of this and come to, well, that's the point. The Vedas give the knowledge that beyond this existence which we're presently in which suffering is guaranteed, there is a state that we all crave for. That is a state of permanent, unlimited happiness. That is reality. What is ultimate reality? And the Vedas inform us also, that is love. What is that love? It's not the cheap thing that's advertised in this world as love, but a completely giving oneself to that person who is completely competent to reciprocate with us in every way. That person is the same person who in Abrahamic dogmas is known as God, but that person is a very loving, sweet, kind, beautiful person. Love is supreme. So I went very quickly into to give an overview of reality as understood from the Vedas, which are accepted by the followers of the Vedas as being axiomatically true, because it's knowledge that this chair here is a greenish kind of color. That's true. It's not. You can argue about it as much as you like. You can try and redefine the word greenish, but it's that state of existence, whichever language you describe it in, if you describe it accurately, then that's knowledge about it. So the Vedas, they describe reality. They describe the reality which we can never ascertain by our own effort, being tiny living beings, that which is beyond the power of our senses to immediately understand. They give us the process by which we can come to that platform beyond the suffering of this material world. That consciousness has been called in English, well, it's a mixture of English and Sanskrit, Krishna consciousness. So that's the basis. Now, I said many things which no doubt just in the course of this talk, which I'm just winding up now, I said many things which no doubt could be contested. And in fact, anything can be contested. Beyond some very basic things, just like you could contest that, you could say, for instance, that Belfast is not a city in Northern Ireland. You could contest that. But it wouldn't be a very good idea to do so. It would be pointless to do so. Very basic facts can be accepted by pretty much everyone as axioms. Beyond that, we're going to have to go with some measure of faith. Spiritual knowledge means, when we talk about spiritual knowledge and not just spiritual belief or spiritual fancy, means that it's knowledge, but it's not something that's quantifiable. We can't measure it. How long or high or deep or what's its density, or there's no way to measure it as such, but it is experiential knowledge. Just like if you drink some, what should we say, milkshake, and you say, oh, it tastes nice, that is it's experiential knowledge. Something that we experience. I'm told today is a nice day in Ireland. It's a warm day in Northern Ireland. For me, because I'm used to living in a much warmer climate, I think it's quite cool. It's experiential. So measurement, I'm just making the point here that measurement is not the only factor. It's measurement is not the only measure of knowledge. There's experience also. So emotions of love, hate, desire, repulsion. This is all on the experiential problem. As living beings, we live more on the experiential platform than on the hard, cold platform of measurement. So that is where we really belong. So I'll finish, and now you can pull out the rotten tomatoes. No eggs, please. We're vegetarians, and we don't consider eggs vegetarian. Questions, comments, protests? You liked a lot of what I said. Thank you. You have a good ability to assimilate science. Why religious belief? No, not necessarily that religious belief and science should contradict each other. Yeah. Well, there are many people who say that. And there are some people who say that, well, science doesn't need religious belief. But my point anyway is that I'm a layman as far as science is concerned. Yeah, can I'll just reiterate that point that I'm making. That as a layman, when one group of scientists say, with all the same data and research material, and the same basic training, one group of scientists say, we are here now due to random interactions of matter, which eventually evolved into simple living beings, and now we have complex living beings. And another group of scientists with the same training and the same data available to them say, no, it's by intelligent design. So from my perspective as a layman, there's no way I can understand what is actually scientific, because both groups claim to interpret in a scientific way the same data. They're both qualified, but they come to completely opposite conclusions. That was the point I was making. I'm not making a plea here for intelligent design, although I do accept it, but I'm not going to get into that. That would probably be presumptuous of me to do so, because I'm not a scientist. It would be. I mean, on a theoretical level, I could, but, well, actually, even not on a theoretical level, just take a book, any book. There's this idea, if you had enough monkeys typing for enough time, you could get all the works of Shakespeare. But it's much more reasonable to think that Shakespeare wrote them, or someone wrote them. It's a much better theory. Most of intelligent design is based on very bad science. Manipulated science. Yeah. Yeah. So you say that intelligent design must be wrong because a minority of scientists subscribe to it. Yeah, you can put it either way. The majority reject it as bad science. But my point is that I don't know, because there are people who are qualified scientists who, it seems, they have nothing to gain in their career from promoting this. In the case of Behe, he had his conversion. He didn't come from a religious background and then say, well, he didn't superimpose his religious beliefs on evolutionary theory and say, well, I don't believe in it. But by his studies, he came to the conclusion that this is not possible by chance. So the fact that the majority of scientists reject it, and it's only a minority who accept it, well, that doesn't necessarily mean that the majority is correct. And there are many scientific... I mean, there was a majority of scientists at one time who believed that the universe is eternal. And it took time for the Big Bang Theory to catch on. Well, that's what I'm saying. As a layman, it may be that those who are now in the minority, they'll become a majority. Because as it said, that scientific theories don't change. The old scientists just die out. No, this is... if you just catch the second... The old scientists who are... My point is that people are attached to certain theories. I mean, it's very clear if we see Richard Dawkins that he's not acting exactly from the platform of neutrality, but he's on a mission. And even though there is a lot of evidence, actually, that I'm aware of as a layman, to contradict evolutionary theory. For instance, there have been many findings of artifacts clearly made by humans, such as bowls in rock literally hundreds of millions of years old. You don't believe that's possible, because such findings are suppressed. Well, yeah. If you want to get into it, I as I said, I shouldn't get into a discussion of this because I'm not a qualified scientist. But scientist isn't said, yeah. Yeah. Newton didn't make laws. He proposed them. The law's already there. That's what I'm saying about knowledge. The knowledge is there. It's already existing. We may know it or not knowing, but the knowledge is there. Yeah. Yeah. It has its limitations. That's the point. That's the point I'm trying to make. There is a book called Forbidden Archaeology. It's this thick. It's boring like anything, like most archaeology books. But it lists literally hundreds of instances through the last 150 years or so of discoveries of artifacts. I'm just speaking on the top of my head here, the discovery of them has been suppressed because it doesn't fit the orthodox scientific theories. So, something like that, yeah. Something like that. But as the authors point out, it's not that there's an organized conspiracy. It's just that people believe what they want to believe. And scientists are humans also. And so when they find something that doesn't fit in their paradigm of reality, they tend to just reject it. They tend. Not always true, that they all will always investigate it. Well, that is the hope, that in science new discoveries are made by finding the unknown and then trying to explain it. But there is often resistance to that also. For instance, I recently saw a video about people who still believe in solid state of the universe and that there wasn't a Big Bang, solid state theory. One of them, who was a big astronomer, when he made a report of his observations, something to do with the red shift, there was a red shift of a next to a small star, and that was right next to a big star which had a much smaller redshift, which throws out the whole Big Bang theory if it was true. And when he reported this, he sent this to a scientific journal, and it was sent back with the editor just gave the comment, "This exceeds my imagination." And then after that, he was regularly given time to look through the Hubble telescope, and then he was cut out from that. So these kind of things happen because scientists are human also. I mean, science should work in a neutral, dispassionate manner, but it doesn't always. Because scientists are human. We all have a worldview that we subscribe to. Because it has implications. There are implications to the idea that there is nothing beyond matter. Why is intelligent design being so much contested if it's just a few nutcase scientists? Because it has implications. The implications are that there's a designer, and certain people who don't want to even entertain those implications. Yeah. You were going to say something? I see, okay. Every culture. In every culture of the world there have been belief in ghosts. Yeah. Well, myself, when I was a teenager, by independent reading, I came to the conclusion that there are probably many things, important things, which are true, which we are led to believe through the educational system and through the whole culture are not true. And ghosts is one of them, because of the reporting of ghosts throughout the world, even in modern times. I remember as a kid reading a Reader's Digest article about a ghost in a pub in High Wycombe in Buckinghamshire, which and there's that one on the Delta flight which I mentioned. Another thing, I thought there's so much all over the world, there are descriptions of gnomes and elves and fairies and trolls and leprechauns. Don't forget the leprechauns. And dragons. From cultures all over the world. And is it really just some imagination? It led me to think that, well, maybe there is something to it. And we shouldn't just dismiss it all as fairy tales. That doesn't mean there does exist, but it does suggest that there is a certain paradigm that's pushed onto us in the name of culture, and that if you even entertain a belief in the possibility of such things, that there's something wrong with you, you're crazy. It's a very materialistic culture in the sense that from the outset, it rejects the possibility of any platform of existence outside that of matter. Get it? Oh, that's an important point which I didn't come back to. That we inherently understand that there is right and what's wrong, but what is right and what is wrong doesn't depend on what we think ultimately. There is ultimate right and wrong that is independent of what we consider to be right and wrong. In some cultures, killing animals is discouraged. In other cultures, it's encouraged. Some say it's wrong, some say it's right. Can it be right for some and wrong for others? Well, ask the animals when you go to slit their throat if they want to be killed. Do they have a say also? Is there ultimate right and wrong? Yes, there is an absolute right and wrong also. So, thank you very much. Anyone want to make a bigger leap of faith and have some mantra meditation? Any volunteers? Hands up. Who wants some mantra meditation? Okay. All right. So shall we do that? Gopala Acharya, you want to come and lead the mantra meditation? Ready for that? I won't attempt to explain why. Don't have to understand everything all at once. Before you leave, be sure to take some spiritual food. We're calling it spiritual food. Some people say it's a product of the devil. You can believe that if you like. We say it's coming from God. So, please pick it up. Non-violent food. Vegetarian food. Okay, tell them all about it. Mantra meditation. You don't need a microphone. We don't have the mantra written. You can teach them.